I want to thank Perimeter for the invitation. Okay, so first of all, an explanation. I'm a graduate student at Princeton, but I've been doing my thesis research in Brisbane at the University of Queensland. Started under Michael Nielsen, then he left, and I was working with Jared, but it turns out that my work has sort of taken me all over the place. This project is a joint project with Greg Versteeg. He is a graduate student at Caltech, and I was visiting Caltech, and he said, "Oh, I have this idea based on something else that I had done," and he said, "You know, we should work on it." So we got it done. There's the archive reference. So let's get started. First of all, I just want to let you guys know that I actually am a full-fledged quantum information scientist. This is sort of an out there project, but it's a direction that I'd like to head. I'm interested in the connection between information theory and basically anything else that I think is cool. So for instance, quantum field theory I think is pretty cool. Relativity is cool, special and general. So this is going to be about information and quantum field theory. So we're going to start here. So information has been has been prominent in quantum field theory, especially in the study of black holes since the 70s. Hawking radiation, that was the perhaps one of the first applications of information theory in black holes. And Hawking radiation basically says that a black hole has a temperature, and the temperature is proportional to the surface gravity, and the surface gravity is proportional to 1 over the mass of the black hole. So the bigger the black hole, the lower the temperature. And it also turns out because it has a temperature, it has an entropy. This is not directly related to my talk. I'm just introducing it as where information has been prevalent in curved space quantum field theory. This also led to the holographic principle, which is used in string theory and also outside of string theory on its own. Okay, so we can also talk about entanglement in quantum fields. And especially if you have a low temperature state like the vacuum of, say, a scalar field in a flat space-time, very simple system to study. The global modes are separable, but local modes are entangled. And this is a generic feature of spin chains or anything else. Ion traps have this as well. And it means that you have a non-zero entropy in the field in a finite space-time region. So even though the whole state is a pure state, say the vacuum, then if you look at just a finite region of it, you're going to see a higher energy state, mixed state. Yeah?
Just probably a dumb question about your previous slide. So for those of you who have thought about quantum field theory a lot lately,
yep.
You see global modes are separable, local modes are entangled. Can you put a little bit more technical on that? Like, what does that mean?
Well, since it's the first slide, it's not supposed to be too detailed, but what I'm referring to here is, let's say you have a quantum field. You okay with that? Quantum field in space-time. And let's say that the field is in the vacuum state. All right. So that means that the vacuum is it's a tensor product of vacuum for, you know, some wave vector with, you know, vacuum for another wave vector, et cetera. It's just a huge tensor product of zeros in momentum basis. But if you look at it with respect to local modes, those modes will be in an entangled state.
So you're taking your big quantum field and you're decomposing it as a tensor product of subsystems, which are either localized modes or
That's
global
right.
modes.
That's right. Cool. Thank you. Okay, so the approach that I'm going to take for this is an operational approach. Now, that doesn't mean that I'm going to propose an actual experiment that's going to be done. The reason I'm taking an operational approach is there's several reasons for it. First of all, it's closest to the scientific method. If you start studying properties of quantum fields just on their own, and you know, all of these mathematical constructs that we use, sometimes you get hairy answers. So this keeps us close to the scientific method, because the devil's in the experimental details. Keeps the focus on measurable quantities. And historically, it's resolved this sort of approach has resolved paradoxes. For instance, the notion of particles. If you just try to figure out what a particle is in an observer-independent way, then you run into trouble, especially in curved space-time. So particles being observer-dependent, particles being defined as that which particle detectors detect, has been a very useful approach. For instance, Gibbons Hawking radiation, which I'll discuss in a little bit, their result was based on this observation. Okay, so quantum fields have entangling power. So let me explain what I mean by that. So even in flat space-time, as I mentioned, that the local modes are entangled if the field's in the vacuum state. So we have total state being pure, yes?
I was hoping it would just go away, but I don't know the difference between a local mode and a global mode. I just know that they...
Yeah. So, all right, so let's see here. When you quantize your theory, you generally quantize it in terms of momentum eigenstates. But you could also look at, say, for instance, if you had some sort of particle detector and it's going to measure the field in a local region of space. I mean, you can write down an operator like this. It's the field value at some space-time location. You can integrate it over some small region in space and time, and you know, look at the field in that region. And the point is that the measurements that you get here are going to be correlated with measurements that you get in a local region elsewhere. I'm going to show how that actually pans out. The actual technical details of how you go from this tensor product structure to a local one aren't really important for this. It's just that you know that you can expand this in terms of global modes, and that's really all you need to know.
Can you think of it as position and momentum?
Yeah. I mean, you have so it, you know. If you create a photon, if you will, in a momentum eigenstate, then it's going to be some delocalized state. But and so that's done by some you know, phi of p and e operator. So it creates a you know, in position space, it creates a wave of these things. And this is going to be some integral dx dt of phi of x and t with some exponential that I don't want to write down right now. So the point is that this is going to, that's not quite right. It's got A's and A daggers. It doesn't matter. The point is that you, the momentum states are non-localized, and then these things are localized. Okay. So if you have a pure state that's extended over many subsystems, and you just look at a few of them, that those few subsystems are going to have non-zero entropy, because the whole state is pure. So if you look at a subsystem, it can't be pure. So that means that, okay, so where was I? So local modes are entangled. So it turns out that this entangled can be swapped to distant quantum systems via only local couplings. So what this means is if you have a detector here and you have a detector over here, and they both interact with the same quantum field that's in some, you know, low-temperature state, then even if their interactions are local and space-like separated, they can become entangled. And I'll show you exactly how that happens in a minute. This is work that's been pursued by Resnick et al. Greg's and my contribution was to extend it to curve space. So keep going. Another property of what I call entangling power is that it's measurable. You can swap this entanglement to a local system, and you can violate a Bell inequality, or you don't. And that'll tell you whether you were able to entangle your local detectors via local interactions with some global field. So it's measurable in that sense. The ability to entangle is affected by the properties of the detectors that you use, of the field itself, and of space-time, for instance, curvature. You put these two ideas together, and it means that entangling power can be used to measure the properties of the field and of space-time. Very broad, general sense, but that's the motivation for this. Okay, so let's talk about curvature for a second. So if you, yeah.
Good question. Are you ascribing entangling power here to a state, e.g. the vacuum, or to the dynamics of the field?
To an entire universal setup. So you have a universe which has a space-time. It's got a field on that space-time. You've got, you know, detectors that you're going to use. I mean, I'm generalizing the concept, but I always have in mind a specific realization of it. So I'm not speaking in terms of, you know, oh, this universe has exactly this much entangling power. I'm speaking very broadly that if you put a similar setup in this universe to a setup in another universe that's equivalent in most ways, that in some cases it'll be entangled and in other cases it won't. So it's not quantifiable. Yeah, not good to do that. So if you, yes?
Is it okay to think, I mean, it's a simplified assumption that it's that the entanglement would be bipartite, or
does one lose the sort of spirit of the whole thing?
The entanglement is certainly not bipartite because these modes extend forever. There are probably certain, well, I mean, you can divide up the space any way you want. I mean, you can say, you know, I'll take a half, you know, half space this way and half space this way and look at the entanglement between those regions. You can do that. Or you can say, I'm going to look at this region as one system and everything else as another system. You can do that. But that's not really what I'm doing. I'm saying I have this little region, just like, I have this little region here and I have this little region here. And I'm going to look at, and of course, there's some sort of mixed correlated state between them. And I'm going to look at how much of that entanglement can I swap to local quantum systems that are interacting with it. A lot of this will become clear once you see how this actually is implemented. Did you want to ask?
So, but then, when you talk about the bipartite entanglement between the two systems that you have chosen, or when you talk about the entropy of a local region, then it's also the entanglement between that local region versus the rest of the universe.
Yes, you can talk about those things as well. This will become clear once I describe the actual setup. I'm trying to speak in broad terms just to kind of get the concepts across, because I'm trying to link in, you know, quantum information theory, entanglement ideas with quantum fields and curved space. So we'll get into these issues a little bit later. Okay, so if you curve your space-time, you don't have a unique vacuum anymore. And what that means is that observers in one state of motion or in one region, or you know, some observers will see particles when others do not. You never have a situation where nobody sees, sorry, where everybody sees no particles. That would be a universal vacuum. Okay, so another way of thinking about this is that if you curve space, you make detectors go click. This is how Hawking, this is one way that you could think of Hawking radiation. You know, you curve space with a black hole and you see particles from it. Another example is Gibbons Hawking radiation, and that is the radiation that comes from expansion. And I'm going to be talking about that in more detail later. It's the same idea. The interesting thing about both of these, Gibbons Hawking radiation and Hawking radiation with black holes, is that sometimes locally, these look exactly like you've just heated the field up. So now you're in a thermal state. You don't have any curvature, but you're in a thermal state. So it means that if you have a single inertial detector just sitting out there, you can't tell the difference between, if you just have a thermometer sitting out there, it'll register some temperature, and you can't tell whether that temperature is from actual heating of the field in a flat space time, or it's because you've got a black hole nearby, or it's because you've got an expanding space time. But maybe, this is the motivation, can the universes that I described be distinguished by their entangling power? Can you tell whether you're in a flat but heated universe versus an expanding vacuum by whether two detectors become entangled or not? That's what I mean by entangling power. Okay, so the entangling resource that we're going to use is the quantum field. I'm going to be extremely simple here, simple as possible. We're going to start with a spin zero field, scalar field. We're going to let it be massless. We're also going to let it be conformally coupled. Now, there's some questions about what kind of coupling, bless you, what kind of coupling should be used, whether it should be conformal coupling or minimal coupling or even anything else. But we're just going to go with this because it makes the math easier at this point. So what this means is that it's actually coupled directly to the Ricci scalar, which is a measure of the local space-time curvature. This is an okay generalization because there's the Ricci scalar is zero in flat space-time. So what we're doing is taking the flat space result, trying to generalize that situation to curved space. And this is one consistent way to do it. And it allows convenient use of conformal symmetry, which is mathematical systems. So the equation of motion, D'Alembertian mass, which is zero, I just put it in there. And then in the two cases we're going to consider, one case is going to be flat, this term is going to be zero. The other case is going to be an exponentially expanding universe, or a de Sitter universe, I'll tell you about it in a second. And this is actually a constant. So it acts as an effective mass term in some senses, which is why I want to look at this later. But for now, we're just going to leave the coupling as it is. Okay, so the two cases that we're going to compare are thermal state in a flat universe and the vacuum of an expanding universe. So the expanding universe, we're going to be using a de Sitter universe, and that's an exponential expansion. Get into details on this in just a second. And we're going to use the conformal vacuum. I'll tell you what that means in just a second as well. And we're going to use the low temperature, also implying the large universe limit. if you don't understand, just give me a second. The point is, and the reason to compare these two cases, is that an inertial detector responds exactly the same in both cases. And this is the Gibbons-Hawking result from 1977. Okay, so I told you I'd tell you about De Sitter spacetime. Here it is. So the metric for De Sitter spacetime looks like this. If this term weren't here, you'd have the usual Minkowski metric. Because it is there with some positive kappa, you have an expanding universe. So for those cosmologists in here and anybody who studied it, this is in Robertson-Walker form. And the scale factor is e to the 2 kappa t. And what we call the expansion rate is kappa. So the xi are called co-moving coordinates. And world lines of constant xi are inertial trajectories. Furthermore, on these inertial trajectories, proper time, which we call tau, is the same as cosmic time, which is t, this variable here. And in addition, proper distance is e to the kappa t times the co-moving distance. Co-moving distance being just the regular Euclidean distance in these variables. It's conformally flat, which means that there's an overall transformation that you can do. You can basically move this factor outside using a conformal time, and it makes calculations quite easy. So the conformal transformation actually defines what we mean by the conformal vacuum. But perhaps it's easiest to think of this conformal vacuum in the following sense. So the universe has a scale factor, as you can see. So it goes from, I mean, ideally from zero size to infinite size, but we don't need to do that. It goes from small to big. So in the when it's small, it's not expanding very fast. That's when you have, you know, when capital, when t is very much negative, it's not going to be getting, it's not going to be expanding fast. So we're actually in the adiabatic limit for the expansion. So if you imagine that the expansion were off and the universe was small, and then you turn on the expansion slowly, you can adiabatically move into this regime. So you can define a vacuum in flat space before the expansion begins, and that becomes the adiabatic vacuum, which gets propagated. And that is approximately the conformal vacuum. So they coincide, which makes it very convenient. Yes? Well, it's not unique. I mean, it's one way of defining a vacuum, and I just gave a motivation for why it's a good one, because it coincides at large times in the past, at, you know, times far in the past, to a universe that's not expanding very much at all. So it looks flat. You know, around for some period of time, it looks flat, and you can define the normal vacuum, Minkowski vacuum, in that case, and that is unique, and it changes gradually into the conformal vacuum. Yep, I'm going to get to that in, I think, the next slide. Oh, not yet. Okay, so I'm going to talk about what this co-moving coordinate business means. So here I've plotted a bunch of dots here in a universe. And these dots are going to be at constant. Okay, take the location of the dots with respect to the circle as being the co-moving coordinates of the dots. All right, now we're going to take some measure here, which is, you know, some ruler, which could be defined by, you know, sending light signals back and forth between the dots. And this ruler is not going to change. But as the universe expands, if these dots are on co-moving trajectories, then you can see that their location with respect to the disk hasn't changed. That means that they're on these kind of inertial trajectories. Yet the actual physical distance between them, between any two dots, is increasing. Another characteristic of this universe is that even though these dots are accelerating away from each other with this exponential form, none of the dots feel like they're accelerating. And every single dot, if you're an observer here, it would look like you're the center of the universe and everyone else is expanding symmetrically around you. So it's kind of, it's non-intuitive, because, I mean, it looks like, you know, you see your buddy over there and you're like, wow, he's really moving fast, he's accelerating, he must be feeling a huge force. But he's looking at you saying, wow, he's really accelerating fast, he must be feeling a huge force, and neither of you is feeling anything. So it's one of those weird weird curve space GR situations, which is why I love it. Anyway, we'll keep going. So as this gets bigger, that's just what happens. Okay. So some more properties of the De Sitter spacetime. First of all, there's a causal horizon. So objects with a separation greater than inverse kappa are causally disconnected. And what that means is that light from one will never make it to the other. and therefore signals from one can never make it to the other, and vice versa. Another interesting property is Gibbons and Hawking showed that an inertial particle detector, so one that's, for instance, on a co-moving trajectory, responds to the de Sitter vacuum as if it were in a bath of thermal particles. So if you had a thermometer sitting out there that interacts with this field to measure the temperature of the field, and you know somebody set this up to be in the conformal vacuum, the expansion starts, and all of a sudden the universe will look heated up to that inertial detector. So you have this vacuum, but nevertheless, you're detecting particles in it. Okay, so the perceived temperature is proportional to the expansion rate, with incidentally the exact same formula as for the black hole radiation. It's called the Gibbons-Hawking temperature. It's just kappa over 2 pi in natural units. And large universe means low temperature. So if you take this result and combine it with this result, it means that if temperature is big, kappa is big, so the horizon would be small. And you can't have that. So it means that the temperature has to be small for there to be a large region of space that's causally connected. So for instance, just for giggles, if you have a Gibbons-Hawking temperature that's about the cosmic microwave background, 2.7 Kelvin, that corresponds to a horizon size of about 0.1 millimeters. So we know that we know this for other reasons too, but this obviously shows that the cosmic microwave background is not caused simply by de Sitter expansion. Yes?
Any observers that don't see a non-zero temperature?
An expert would be able to answer that. I am not an expert. I don't know. Okay, so here is the thought experiment that I'm going to do. This is where it gets operational. So we've got two satellites, if you will, just sitting out there in space. They've got some separation L, and time is going to be drawn this way, so the space-time diagram. The interaction, so each of these satellites has a detector on it. And the detector is some sort of qubit, two-level system. You can think of it as an atom or whatever the heck you want to think of it as. But it interacts with the field in a controlled manner, in a time-dependent manner. And furthermore, the detection time that it's on, I'm going to call sigma. So sigma is chosen to be small compared to the separation, meaning that the detection events are space-like separated. In addition, we're going to use co-moving trajectories in both cases. Remember, we're comparing de Sitter expansion, de Sitter vacuum expansion to a thermal state in flat space-time. So in both, you can define co-moving trajectories. It's just, you know, this co-moving distance is not changing. And in the flat case, the physical distance would not be changing. But in the de Sitter case, these things would begin to move away from each other. But they would be doing so slowly because we assume that the temperature and thus the expansion rate is quite small. So it wasn't clear to us that this was, this certainly is not the only way to generalize the concept, but it was the simplest and a good thing to do first. So we'll see where this leads us. Oh, the important thing about the co-moving trajectory is that it's inertial. So neither satellite feels any forces on it. And that's the physical connection that the detectors, what am I trying to say?
It's locally each detector doesn't have a way of determining whether it's in either universe. If it were accelerating to keep itself at the same distance away from the other one, then it would know that there's something weird going on because it's feeling acceleration. Okay, so the properties of the detectors. They're qubits with a tunable energy gap, call it omega. We're going to use a simple local field coupling. I'll tell you what that is in a second. And the trajectories are inertial. In addition, the detection events are non-causal. And readout is delayed. So we actually let the qubit interact with the field, and then we don't do projective measurement yet because we want to tell whether it's entangled or not. So the interaction Hamiltonian looks like this. So this is in the interaction picture. Tau is the proper time for each satellite. It's going to be the same. It's also going to be the same as cosmic time, T in the other slide. So I'm going to go through each of these. So let me start here. Phi is the scalar field that we're interested in. And it's the field value at the location of a given satellite along its world line. So the satellite has a world line defined by x of t. sorry, x of tau, and we're taking the field value at the satellite. That's what that term means. And we're going to couple it to the monopole operator or the sigma x operator in the interaction picture for the local two-level system. This is a time-dependent, we call it a window function. It allows us to turn on and off the interaction. If you wanted to get really physical about it, the closest analogy might be if you had an atom in an optical cavity, but the cavity was such that the walls could be made entirely reflective or entirely transparent in a time-dependent fashion. So you have this atom, you prepare it in the ground state, and you don't interact it with anything. The walls are entirely reflective. Then you change the reflectivity to let it interact with the background EM field, and then you close it up again in some time-dependent fashion. That's sort of the idea that we have with this. But this is, we don't really need to go that far. I just wanted to sort of motivate it. This is a standard. It's called a DeWitt monopole coupling. And this function we take to be a Gaussian. Now, before you get to me about the tails, I'll tell you about the tails of the Gaussian. So it's a Gaussian with sigma. Sorry. So it turns out that some people might object that it's not really space-like separated because the tails extend down here. That is a valid concern, but it turns out not to matter. In fact, none of the results would change if you adiabatically switched it off to zero exactly, say, in this region here. That's, say, you know, several sigma beyond, but still within the space-like separated region from the other. So none of the results depend on the fact that the tails go to plus or minus infinity. It's just a nice, convenient approximation. So intuitively, we can think of this as inducing a transition in the two-level system at a strength proportional to the local field value. That's how you should think of this Hamiltonian. And it's, again, it's a local interaction. Okay, so entanglement. So we need to talk about entanglement a bit. Robin introduced this topic probably. We only need like one more concept. So there's going to be a density matrix of the joint two-level systems after the interaction, and it has this form. Now, the rows and columns correspond to ground state, ground excited ground, both of them excited. So that's what this density matrix corresponds to. The diagonal entries correspond to the probabilities for those various configurations. All of these are assumed to be small, except for the one, of course. So most of the time, of course, nothing happens because you're in the vacuum. There's a weak coupling. Nothing happens. But sometimes you get one detector excited, the other detector excited, and sometimes you get both detectors excited. The only quantities we're going to worry about are A and X. You don't need to worry about B and C, but I just want to show you the form of it. Okay, so it turns out that two qubits are entangled if and only if a quantity called the negativity is greater than zero. So the negativity is defined by taking this density matrix, doing a partial transpose, which in this form corresponds to transposing each of the blocks like this. So the B and the X were exchanged, the B star and the X star were exchanged, and looking for negative eigenvalues. So if there are any negative eigenvalues, you take their magnitudes, sum them up, and that's what you call the negativity. So in this case, the only place that we could get negative eigenvalues are from here. So this state is going to be entangled if and only if this quantity, the magnitude of X, is bigger than A. So what do these things mean? Well, X is the amplitude for virtual particle exchange. That's how you should think about this. And A is the probability for a single detector to get excited. And we use perturbation theory to calculate these. We're assuming weak coupling. Okay, so let's take a look at the flat vacuum case, Minkowski space, T equals zero. Well, this is nice because it's a limit of the other two cases. You take the temperature in the thermal case to zero, or you take the expansion rate to zero, and you get this. But the question would be, why are particles detected at all in this case? I mean, the detectors aren't accelerated. The universe is totally flat. It's in the vacuum. Why do we see particles? Well, it turns out it's because of the finite detection time, and only because of the finite detection time. You can think of it in terms of a time-energy uncertainty relation, that if you only make measurements for some finite time, then you can't tell whether it's really in the vacuum or not with absolute precision. So for fixed L, we have this diagram. So at some separation, this is what the what was A? A was the probability for a single detector to get excited, and X was the amplitude for the detectors to exchange a virtual particle through the field. So A is going to be, let's see, what am I going to say about this? Oh, the subscript here means the vacuum. So entanglement is really a competition, if you remember the previous slide, a competition between X and A. So when X is less than A, noise dominates and you don't get entanglement. But if you can go to a high enough detection frequency, although these both go to zero quite rapidly, there is a region where the amplitude for virtual particle exchange is actually bigger than the local noise in each detector, and that corresponds to entanglement. It's the resonant frequency. Okay, so this is what the results look like for the flat vacuum. So this is the separation scaled by the detection time, unitless answer, and this is the resonant frequency times the detection time, also unitless. And here's the cutoff. This region is entangled, this region is not. So I found that quite nice. And this agrees with Resnick's results. This is what he did. Actually, no, I don't say that. This is not what he did, but this is the same setup that he studied. Okay.
I can't quite tell. That line is the slope less than one.
Yeah, actually, the slope of the line depends on sigma. In fact, I mean, it's always going to be straight, but depending on what sigma is, it completely changes. It's dependent on sigma. In addition, there's a little. It actually doesn't go straight to zero. It looks like this. In the region 1, 2, real close to the end, and that's from the finite detection time. So sigma really just acts as an overall time scale for the whole problem, scaling everything by that. Okay, so let's look at the thermal state. So we're still in Minkowski space, but now we've heated it up. All right, so I'm going to tell you a little bit about these functions and what makes them interesting. So these functions both have the same prefactor. And it turns out that you can factor that out. Since the competition between local detector noise and virtual particle exchange, if you factor this out, you're really looking at a function only of omega compared with a function only of L. So if we fix L, then entanglement occurs if this function of omega is less than some constant value, which depends on L, of course. So it turns out, though, that if T is greater than 0, then F of omega has some finite minimum. What that means is that since G of L, which I haven't proven to you, but just trust me on this, it decreases monotonically with L, entanglement is restricted to some finite region, which means that if you're beyond this L max, you'll never get entanglement. So just to show you what kind of functions we're dealing with, if you remember the picture on the previous slide, it looks something like this. And then this intersection point defined the entangled region. If you get rid of the prefactor, then it looks like this. So this is X, and this is A. So that's for the vacuum case, without the prefactor multiplied away. But in the thermal case, when you take away the prefactor, you end up with something like this. So what that means is that the entanglement is going to be restricted to a finite region. In addition, if you take the further away you go, the lower this line ends up. So at a further L, you could be down here, and you won't see any entanglement at all because you're below the minimum. So let's see how that plays out on the graph. It also turns out that you can calculate the maximum frequency in this case. So here are the results for the thermal case. So here again is the vacuum Minkowski cutoff. And now we have the entanglement cutoff for the thermal case. So here it's never entangled in either. Here it's only entangled if T equals 0. But for the chosen temperature, which in these units, detection time times 2 pi T is 0.001, this is the entangled region. And you can see that there's a maximum L beyond which you're not going to get any entanglement. And okay, thank you. And there's a maximum frequency above which you're never going to get any entanglement. Okay, so let's look at the de Sitter vacuum. Again, it's useful to compare it to the thermal case because of the local equivalence through the Gibbons-Hawking result. So because of that local equivalence, the local detector noise in the de Sitter case is exactly the same as the local detector noise in the thermal case, as long as we set the temperature in the two to be at the Gibbons-Hawking temperature. The virtual particle exchange function is more complicated than the thermal one, but it shows similar behavior. I'm not going to analyze it like this. I'm just going to show you what it looks like. The entangling power turns out to be different. And here it is. So this is the vacuum cutoff. The purple line is the thermal cutoff. And the yellow line is the de Sitter cutoff. So interestingly, there is a region in which a parameter region given by separation and detector resonance frequency, where detectors will be entangled if the universe is flat but heated, but not if it's expanding. So I found this rather surprising. And in fact, it was kind of interesting, because when we first did this calculation, we screwed it up. And we used bad approximations. And we were only looking at this region. And this yellow curve actually appeared on the other side. And we got really excited about this, because we thought, oh, wow, so it looks like, you know, the de Sitter case, you know, virtual particles are emitted from the horizon, and they're entangling the detectors, et cetera, et cetera. And it was all wrong. Like, the intuition that you get for why the entanglement occurs just doesn't seem to pan out. If anybody has intuition about this, I'd love to hear it. But we told people about this, and everyone thought that that would be the result. But it turns out it goes the other way, that for this particular detector setup, the entangling power of a thermal Minkowski state universe, if you will, is stronger than a de Sitter one. So let's look at the results here. So the de Sitter vacuum and a heated field in flat spacetime have exactly the same effect on a single inertial detector. But the two universes can be distinguished by entanglement. In the de Sitter vacuum, it has less entangling power than Minkowski thermal state, again, with respect to this particular detector setup. So, and of course, both have less power than the Minkowski vacuum, which has the least local noise. OK, so in conclusion, quantum fields possess entangling power in some general sense. Properties of the field, such as the quantum state, and properties of spacetime, such as curvature, affect this. And therefore, the entangling power can be used to detect curvature. Now, the whole motivation for this project, again, was to link a quantum information concept, like entanglement, to a concept from gravity, quantum field theory, things that aren't usually put together. In this case, we're using entanglement to detect curvature. Yes. So future work, generalizations, certainly we can go to a massive field. We can change the coupling to the Ricci scalar. In fact, I want to know, the first calculation I want to do is see what happens if we just use minimal coupling. Maybe we'll get the same thing, I don't know. Relative motion of the detectors. One thing that you can do right away is to have the detectors, okay, so imagine they have rockets. And they fire a burst of their rockets so that they start sailing toward each other in the de Sitter case. And if they're moving toward each other slowly, then there's going to be at some point where they're effectively stationary with respect to the actual distance between them, instead of always separating. So that's another thing I'd like to check. Further down the road, change the detector couplings, higher spin fields, more degrees of freedom for entanglement, like momentum, and also non-inertial detectors. Other types of curvature as well. And acknowledgments, John Preskill, Sean Carroll from Caltech, Gerald Milburn from UQ, and Carl Cates, who's visiting UQ at the time as well. And organizations, Caltech was nice enough to host me during two visits that let this work, and funding from the NSF and the DoD. So thank you.
When you were comparing what you call conformal coupling with normal coupling, could you just explain to me, I mean, isn't normally in general relativity anything other than minimal coupling regarded as inconsistent with the strong equivalence principle?
I don't know. Is it?
Well, you have field equations in which the Ricci scalar appears.
Mm-hmm.
And that violates the equivalence principle.
I don't know the answer to that. I'm not an expert in this field, so I definitely don't know the answer. But it doesn't. I don't think so. I mean, it's the only. It's usually touted as the only extra. It's the only coupling to curvature that's consistent with the symmetries. I mean, it's a scalar coupling. It's the only one that you can do. There's some coefficient times a Ricci scalar. I'm pretty sure Burrell and Davies would have something to say about that, but I don't.
No, but he's right. I mean, if you have a manifold that has a non-zero Ricci scalar, then if you go locally in some local frame, then that's a finite value, and it will affect your equation morphism, right? So you would be able to detect that you're not in that space, but that you have curvature. You shouldn't locally be able to do this.
This is actually a non-local measurement, and locally, I mean, locally, it's. I see what you're saying.
Why did you put the conformal term in there?
Just so that we have a conformal symmetry, and it'll be easy to do the calculation.
Oh, it helped you to simplify the calculations.
Yeah, that's right.
But do you see that? Are you sure that your results are stable under perturbations of that?
No, definitely not. No, this is just the first crack at it, and there's nothing.
So you're definitely not stable, or definitely you don't know.
Definitely, we don't know. Yeah, thanks for clarifying. So we don't. I mean, that's the one of the first things I want to check is what is the effect of mass on this? What is the effect of a different Ricci scalar coupling? It's certainly a valid way. I mean, barring the objection that was just made, which I don't know how to respond to. It is a valid way to generalize because in both cases it reduces to Minkowski minimally coupled. Conformally coupled to Minkowski space is minimally coupled, so it's the same. So it's not clear that it's not clear what coefficients should go in front of R.
Well, but if you want that on a curved space, it locally looks like Minkowski space. And
yeah.
You don't want the coefficient there.
But that doesn't affect this curve. It doesn't affect A at all, which is interesting.
Okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
You said that this entanglement power is bounded by L and omega.
Yeah.
Right. Can you just explain again what L and omega were?
L is the detector separation.
Yes.
And omega is the detector resonant frequency.
Yeah.
That's right. And it's assumed to be the same in both of them. There's two local detectors, and they're both assumed to be identical.
No, but what I meant by L is how far apart can you take them and still have a finite entanglement power?
How far apart can you take? Oh, well,
what's that scale?
I don't have it anymore. Sorry, that's what?
What's that scale?
Oh, yes, I forgot to mention this crab. So you had something that looked like this, and then the other one was inside of it. Yeah, this was an important point that I forgot to mention. There was a line here, and this was the cosmic horizon. So the detector, in order to actually see any appreciable difference, the detectors have to be beyond the cosmic horizon from each other. Now, that's not a problem for actually measuring this, because you can imagine that there's one detector here, there's one detector here, and while they're outside the cosmic horizon from each other, in the de Sitter case, they're within the cosmic horizon of some home planet, if you will. And so they can communicate, they can make local measurements here, and local measurements here. It turns out you can always do this to detect entanglement. If you have multiple copies of the state, you see multiple detectors per satellite, they do some sort of local quantum protocol and make local measurements without communicating, and just send their measurements back to the home planet, and they can determine whether Bell inequality was violated or not. But yes, this is set by the would-be cosmic horizon kappa inverse.
But that would mean that you couldn't even, in the best of circumstances, could use it for quantum computing.
Well, no, not necessarily, because, I mean, if you're in the flat thermal case, there is no horizon.
Just saying then about
what I was saying here is that, okay, What I'm saying is that the two detectors can't communicate with each other, but they can communicate with a third party, one directionally. They can send data to a third party.
For what purpose do they have to be at least so much apart?
In order to see the separation between the de Sitter curve and
the thermal curve. Between the de Sitter and the thermal.
Yeah, but this whole region is entangled in both,
right.
Or in, at least in the thermal curve. Yeah.
One more question. Yeah.
To better understand the picture, then in the large thermodynamic, the large temperature limit, the entropy associated with this entanglement, how does, have you looked at how it behaves?
The entropy associated with this? I don't understand the question. Can we
explain? It's like when you look at the entanglement that you mentioned at the beginning, that you integrate out another region, right?
Yeah.
Then if you would do that for, then you have this concept of geometric entropy.
Yes.
And if you do it for a thermal state,
yes.
Then you would like that in the large temperature limit, this is dominated by the volume times the temperature cube, so that usual classical result. And in here, what would be the
Well, this isn't, remember, this is not the entanglement of the field. This is how much entanglement has been, it's not the same. It's how much entanglement has been swapped to local detectors. So, I mean, we didn't do any analysis of the actual field entanglement. We're looking at whether these local two-level systems, these local qubits, were entangled by this particular interaction that we used. Okay?
I'm busy.
All right, thanks.
Thanks. That's my name.